forget who's beside you. Never trust the ones that get when everyone is looking after you. On the streets and through the air, watching all those familiars now. Tell me that you're a nation under God. Just listen, baby. They try to squeeze every time you try to breathe. Radio, 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 Caroline. Radio, 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 Caroline. I always listen for your heartbeat in the sky. Shout it out with a breath of freedom. Clash of sounds to unite the kingdom. Spreading over waves and through the air. Vance and Robbie Dale, and they all set the sails, kept the dial open to the world. Just listen, baby. They try to squeeze every time you try to breathe. Radio, radio, radio. Radio, 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 Caroline. I always listen for your heartbeat in the radio, 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 Caroline. Radio, 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 Caroline. I always listen for your.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
We begin today's show in the United Kingdom, where Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal was crushed Tuesday in the biggest defeat for a sitting British government in modern history. After months of build-up, May's plan for withdrawing Britain from the European Union was voted down 432 to 202, fomenting political uncertainty about the future of Britain as well as May's leadership. John Bercow, the Speaker of the UK House of Commons, called the roll.
Eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432. Wow.
The nose or dare? The eyes to the right, 202. The nose to the left, 432. So the nose have it. The nose have it. Unlock. On a point of, indeed, point of order, the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the House has spoken and the government will listen. It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support. Nothing about how. Nothing about how or even if it intends to honour the decision the British people took in a referendum Parliament decided to hold. And people, particularly EU citizens who've made their home here, and UK citizens living in the EU, deserve clarity on these questions as soon as possible.
The UK is scheduled to leave the European Union in 10 weeks, but the rejection of the Brexit deal leaves ambiguity about what will happen next. Shortly after Tuesday's vote, Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed Parliament, calling for a vote of no confidence today in Theresa May's government.
The result of tonight's vote is the greatest defeat for a government since the 1920s in this House. This is a catastrophic defeat for this government. After 2 years of failed negotiations, the House of Commons has delivered its verdict on her Brexit deal, and that verdict is absolutely decisive. I therefore, Mr. Speaker, inform you I have now tabled a motion of no confidence in this government. Will be debated tomorrow, so this House can give its verdict on the sheer incompetence of this government and pass that motion of no confidence in the government.
That was Tuesday. Today, Labour leader Corbyn said he misspoke when he called the vote the largest defeat since the 1920s, saying, in fact, it's the largest defeat in the UK's democratic history. Parliament is currently debating Corbyn's no-confidence motion and will vote at 2 p.m. Eastern Time today. The future of Britain's relationship with the European Union hangs in the balance. If May's government survives a no-confidence vote, it will have the option of introducing a milder Brexit deal or proposing a new Brexit referendum altogether. If the no-confidence vote passes, it could trigger a general election. 71 Labour members of Parliament have signed a public statement calling for a new Brexit referendum, arguing a Brexit renegotiation, which Jeremy Corbyn has been pushing for, is unrealistic. Their statement said, quote, no deal would be a catastrophe, which we must resolutely oppose. Meanwhile, The Guardian reports Theresa May has not invited Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn to cross-party Brexit talks, despite her epic defeat on Tuesday. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by Paul Mason, New Statesman contributing writer, author, and filmmaker. His latest piece for the New Statesman is headlined, "To Avoid a Disastrous Failure, Labour Must Now Have the Courage to Fight for Remain." Mason's most recent book is titled, "Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future." Paul Mason, welcome back to Democracy Now! Please explain what
Great
happened.
Well, Amy, just let me put this into context for American viewers. Imagine Trump said, let's leave NAFTA. Okay, the right of American politics would applaud. But if he said, we're leaving NAFTA, but we're following NAFTA's rules so Canada and Mexico get to determine America's trade policy, there'd be uproar on both sides of your House of Representatives. And that's effectively what happened last night in British politics. The far right of the Tory party and all the other progressive parties combined together to defeat May. So 230 out of a 650 parliament, that was the margin. And it leaves her not only facing the worst defeat a government's ever faced, but this is the only piece of legislation her government was elected to do. It is a one-trick pony, and the trick just failed. So that's why she's facing now the vote of no confidence. I don't think, unfortunately, Jeremy Corbyn is going to be able to defeat her tonight, because those self-same right-wingers who voted against the deal have no interest in putting Corbyn into power. So we've got a government that needs to fall, but cannot fall.
For people who don't exactly understand what Brexit is, please explain.
The way it goes now is that if Corbyn were able to win a vote of no confidence against Theresa May, there would have to be a general election. Now, that's something that is not only, you know, politically unpalatable to the right and, of course, the corporate elite here in Britain, but this crisis we're living through here in Britain with Brexit is the end point of a 40-year period of neoliberal economics. It's become very focused, as it has in your country, on xenophobia, white nationalism, free trade, all these themes are there. And basically, the corporate elite cannot afford to see this Tory government fall when the only alternative is the most radical and most left-wing Labour Party we've ever had. That's why you've got this complete stasis and paralysis in British politics. And of course, we're not the only players here. We're dealing with a continent with 500 million citizens, Europe, which is waiting for an answer. And the press here in Europe, you know, we've been awake for 4 or 5 hours now on this side of the Atlantic, is appalled by what has happened. We've got one of the most powerful governments in the world, a key NATO ally, just in chaos.
Interesting you mentioned NATO, because new discussion is taking place in the United States about revelations that Trump has repeatedly wanted to pull the United States out of NATO.
Yeah, and look, here in Europe, the far right are being heavily, heavily funded and promoted by Vladimir Putin. At the same time, I think America is, by many people now, looked at as an unreliable ally because of these revelations about Trump. My opposition to Brexit is not just for economic reasons, because we need, in a very unstable world, we need to create alliances here on the continent of Europe that show stability and the rule of law and democracy. In Poland, only 2 days ago, the mayor of a major city was murdered. You know, we have political violence now in our continent. We want to calm things down. And we want to be able to do it, of course, in a way that speaks to those poor communities that are being dragged towards the right, dragged towards this right-wing populist xenophobic politics. But we cannot really do it by abandoning our values. You mentioned in your headlines, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we on this side are very inspired by AOC, as she's called, because here we see a left politician fighting from the heart with values. We want to be doing some of that. And I personally want to get this Brexit thing concluded. I want to get rid of this Theresa May government. But Brexit concluded because we need to try and win back some of those dislocated communities, the ex-industrial communities. We need to do it from the heart, not with technocratic language and parliamentary manoeuvring. The problem we have here on the left of politics, you know, we are in some ways similar to the Democrats in America, but in one way we are not. Hillary Clinton used to be accused of being the Wall Street candidate. We have no support amongst our own corporate elite. What we achieve in the British Labour movement will be achieved with working class and lower middle class votes only. And so our electoral alliance will never be with our Wall Street, the City of London. It will always be, let me put it this way, an alliance between Brooklyn, Chicago and West Virginia. Those kinds of demographics. And so we have to keep West Virginia, our equivalent of it, in our alliance. That's quite hard when they voted to leave Europe. Now, we know, because we are out there on the doorstep of working class communities, that one of the things that drove some of them to support Brexit was the idea that in a world of limited resources, then we don't want to share those resources with migrant people who come from Europe. This is the xenophobic argument. And so what Corbyn is doing there, he's turning the argument back to where the real blame is. The blame is that we bailed the banks out with the money of the taxpayer, and the taxpayer therefore had to make a choice, bail the banks or fund the healthcare system. That is the argument that we in the labour movement and the trade union movement are having every day of the week to try and bring back, because we're determined not to abandon these blue-collar, you know, Rust Belt-type communities to far-right politics. We're going to win them back. So that's what Corbyn's trying to do there, and link the severe social dislocation and poverty in Britain to the non-answer of Brexit.
Could we see British Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, Paul?
Yes, and you could see it within 2 weeks if he wins one of these votes. He's going to move this no confidence motion. You can move one any day of the week. So if he loses tonight, he can wait and do it again. In the interim, we're going to see the middle of Parliament, the centre in both parties, try to cobble together some solution. They may do it. But the problem is then that has to go back to a negotiation with Brussels, and Brussels will only negotiate with the government. It can't negotiate with Parliament. So ultimately, every solution leads to a new election. And in that election, it'll be very hard fought, because we've already got Steve Bannon's money pouring into British politics. The dark, opaque money of Russia and the money of people like Bannon is out there, and they're going to try and fund the same thing they funded in your country. But we have one thing. We have a mass active party of progressive and left-wing people, and we're going to fight for the soul of Britain if that election comes.
What do you mean the money of Bannon?
Well, look, Bannon has been trying to set up a multinational movement of European right-wing parties that wants to change European politics in the coming European parliamentary election. There probably won't be a European parliamentary election in the United Kingdom, but we're hearing all kinds of things about Bannon, Farage, who was the leader of this far-right party, UKIP, and now some people like Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is a right-wing member of the Conservative Party, but interestingly, in Parliament this week, he for the first time used the words deep state. So he's saying the deep state is stopping Brexit. Now, where does that rhetoric come from? It's the rhetoric of Bannon. It is the rhetoric of the alt-right in America. You know, on our social media, not so much in our civil society face-to-face, but on our social media, my goodness, we are inundated with the fake news and the rhetoric of the Breitbarts and the InfoWars. It's all over the British social media. And that's what's going to be unleashed if there's a new Brexit referendum.
What is happening now with Ireland? How is this being viewed in Ireland and Northern Ireland?
Hopefully some of your viewers know that the United Kingdom is the United Kingdom of Britain and Northern Ireland. And Northern Ireland is a six-county enclave which was separated off from the rest of Ireland after a civil war. It itself has a big religious divide. Now, the Catholic community in Northern Ireland does not send its MPs by and large to Parliament. Sinn Féin, which largely represents the anti-unionist community, the Catholics, does not come to Parliament. It boycotts Parliament. The unionist part of that society is represented by a religious right party called the DUP. Now, they hold the balance of power. Theresa May doesn't have a majority in the British Parliament. She only has a majority with this right evangelical Christian type party, the DUP. Now, they're backing her, even though they didn't support last night's deal. And that's the paradox. They, too, cannot afford a progressive government because they have this very, very sweetheart kind of deal with the Conservatives, an extra £1 billion whenever they want it, just to keep Theresa May in power. But Ireland as a state, one of the 27 states of the European Union, of course, the Republic of Ireland is a very successful, modernised, liberal, small capitalist country. And they're just looking across the Irish Sea at us, and I think just in despair. Because we are destroying, not just destroying our reputation, we're actually destroying our own democracy. We have allowed the dark money into our democracy. And the biggest problem right now is politicians trying to cross the street with people in Make America Great hats, literally those red hats, chasing them and shouting all kind of fascist rhetoric at them. This is a new phenomenon in British politics. The sudden eruption of kind of weird harassment tactics against politicians. And the Irish are looking at that and saying, you know, how did that happen? Because you're supposed to be one of the richest and most successful and powerful countries in the world.
Do you think there needs to be a new referendum, Paul?
I would, because the alternatives are a softer form of Brexit is going to get through Parliament behind me. And I'm not so much in favour of that. We can't stop Brexit without a referendum, because the legitimacy of that first referendum has to be cancelled out by another one. But Jeremy Corbyn is playing very clever here, because he has to be seen to go to the hilt, to the final mile of trying to make the old referendum, i.e. Brexit, work to soften it, to make it more palatable, to make it less damaging for working people and their families. That's what he's trying to do now. That's the phase we're in. And I agree with that. The argument comes inside the Labour movement. We're going to have to take with us a lot of progressive people, young people, people of colour. And most of them want a second referendum. We also have to take the working class communities of small industrial towns. And a lot of them wanted Brexit. And as I said before, we don't have a Wall Street supporting kind of faction in our left. We just have the working class. So we have to, as it were, keep both halves of it together. And so if we end up with a second referendum, that's got to be fought as a class struggle and not as some kind of huge kind of fanfare for how great Europe is. Europe is a neoliberal construct. It is a right-wing construct. We happen to be in it. Leaving it is worse, but being in it is also not great. So you can imagine the communication challenge that creates for Corbyn, but he's the only person who could have done it. All the other people, the predecessors, the centrists, the kind of weak, kind of bland, classic, middle-of-the-road, centre-left politician would be at sea by now. And yet, as you saw there in the Commons, Corbyn is commanding the situation. And that's why people like me have supported him and continue to support him to the hilt.
I've been selling my name for the sake of who knows. I've been trying to explain how it's all gonna go. I don't take my life for granted. I've been waking up tired day after day. Hope is taking its time to go my way, but I don't take my life for granted. I'm gonna hold on tight to what I've been handed. Oh, you just don't know how long you will have it.
Two bombshell news reports over the weekend have Trump on the defense once more regarding the special counsel's investigation. The New York Times on Friday revealed that the FBI had begun investigating Trump himself in early 2017 when he fired then-FBI Director James Comey just weeks into his presidential tenure. According to the Times, law enforcement officials became so concerned by the president's behavior that they began investigating whether he had been working on behalf of Russia against American interests. And then on Sunday, the Washington Post reported that Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, including on at least one occasion taking possession of the notes of his own interpreter and instructing the linguist not to discuss what had transpired with other administration officials. We turn to Ron Fine, legal director of Free Speech for People, and he's been on our program to talk about that. Welcome back, Ron. First, let's talk about the New York Times report. This report that I don't know if we've ever had such a thing happen that we've known of, that the FBI would open an investigation into a sitting president. And this happened apparently right after Trump fired James Comey. How significant is this?
It's almost beyond conception, because we've had in the past examples of either city officials or state officials, and occasionally presidents, of being corrupt in the ordinary sense. But we've never had a case before of a sitting United States president being credibly suspected of being a foreign asset.
So you have a situation, I'm assuming, where James Comey's colleagues, the people working right under him, saw what happened, where they had their boss being first pressured by Trump over the Russia investigation and then straight fired, seeing that a president who's supposed to allow the FBI to have independence doing something that looked an awful lot like obstruction of justice. And it sounded like they worried that Trump was in Putin's pocket. What do you know that the New York Times found about how far that investigation actually went? Because presumably they would have had to hide what they were doing from the president himself.
That's very difficult because, of course, the FBI is part of the Department of Justice, which ultimately does report to the Attorney General and then on to the president. But we have here a situation that we've never dealt with before as a country, and that's that the president, who we know increasingly for years before he ran for office, had been funding his lavish lifestyle by essentially laundering money for the Russian mafia and foreign oligarchs from various countries, swept into office on a presidential campaign where his senior-most campaign officials were working directly with Russian intelligence. This is, as you say it, it sounds almost fantastical, and yet it's exactly what happened. And then in office, his behavior has been so bizarre, not just supportive of good diplomatic relations with Russia, but so clearly acting in Russia's interests and taking steps to avoid the United States government from understanding what exactly his interactions with Vladimir Putin and other Russians are, that it really does raise the specter that his actions are not just ordinary criminal obstruction of justice, but that he's actually deeply compromised and is under leverage or some sort of control from Russian intelligence.
The special counsel, Robert Mueller, took over that investigation as per the Times report. The Times said it's unclear whether Mr. Mueller is still pursuing the counterintelligence matter, that is, whether the president is acting against the country's interests. How much of this aspect of it do you think is going to play into the Mueller investigation? We are told that the Mueller investigation is essentially wrapping up. It's getting close to its final report. And it looks as though Mueller might have focused more on the issue of obstruction of justice. And I'm wondering, is there a way to even know whether Putin has something on Trump or not?
I don't want to set the bar too high here and then have people, you know, expecting that what we're going to find is all going to be incredible bombshells, because the basic picture has been out in the public eye for a long time, which is that Trump has taken steps to obstruct investigations into himself and his cronies and his subordinates. He's interfered with FBI investigations. And whether Special Counsel Mueller decides that crosses the line into criminal obstruction of justice it's certainly obstructing the administration of justice in a way very parallel to what Richard Nixon did in the 1970s. And again, whatever Mueller concludes on the counterintelligence side as to whether Trump was acting under the direction or control of the Kremlin, it's certainly true that he has been very open, and his campaign was very open, and in office he's been very open to some really extraordinary ways of interacting with the Russian government that go beyond the pale of what we would expect from the President of the United States. And those are impeachable offenses, regardless of what special counsel determines. They cross the line into federal criminal violations, or whether he determines that Trump is actually a foreign asset.
Let's go to the Washington Post report. Coming on the heels of the New York Times article is quite remarkable as well. The title is, Trump has concealed details of his face-to-face encounters with Putin from senior officials in administration. So there's a way presidents are supposed to interact with other heads of state, right? That when you are having a conversation with another head of state, you're essentially conducting foreign policy, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not. And so therefore, those interactions are carefully documented. Often, usually, they are tracked. The details of what the president says are shared with senior administration officials. And it sounds like Trump essentially threw up the rule book, if you will, on his interactions with Putin. As Washington Post, 5 meetings over this 2-year period that were face-to-face meetings that there just isn't a clear written record of. Again, how significant is this?
It's incredibly significant. And when you look at past presidents' interactions, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, when the president is meeting with a foreign leader, they're usually surrounded by various assistants who are taking notes, keeping track of what's going on. And Trump's insistence on meeting with Putin with no one present but a translator is extremely shady. It reminds me of Jared Kushner's attempt to set up a secure channel through the Russian embassy so that Jared Kushner could talk directly to the Kremlin without U.S. intelligence services being able to potentially monitor it. And one of these conversations, the timing is extremely suspicious. He had a conversation with Putin just as the story was breaking about the campaign's meeting at Trump Tower in June of 2016 with Russian intelligence operatives. And it was immediately after that private meeting with Putin that Trump dictated a misleading statement about the purpose of the Trump Tower meeting. And what that suggests is that Trump may have coordinated his message to the American public on what happened in that Trump Tower meeting with none other than Vladimir Putin.
And we also know recently that his former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, shared polling data with Russian government officials, polling data of the U.S. presidential election. So if Trump was having these meetings with Putin that were not properly documented, what does that mean for national security? Is it something that can form the basis of a new Democrat-controlled House to say, this is just not supposed to happen this way, and this is yet another of the list of impeachable offenses?
Absolutely. So what we know so far is enough of the basis for the House of Representatives to begin a process of determining whether to impeach and remove Trump. And what's important to note is that impeachment is not a form of punishment. It's to protect the country. And if the House determines that Trump is acting in a manner that is, in the most charitable interpretation, extremely erratic and questionable, the more likely interpretations indicating that he's compromised in some way, then it absolutely can take steps towards determining that this is an impeachable offense and removing him on this ground, that the framers of the Constitution were specifically worried about the phenomenon of foreign powers helping to bring somebody under their guidance or influence or direction into the presidency, and listed that as a reason for impeachment. And it looks like Trump will be potentially the first example of a president who's actually vindicated that fear. But the framers of the Constitution knew that this was a possibility, and it looks like it's on us.
Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, is due to testify to Congress today. He's been convicted, and he has essentially turned on his previous boss and is eager, it seems, to talk to Democratic members of the House who've asked for his testimony. Trump can't seem to stop talking about it. Is this, as far as you can tell, the Democrats creating a paper trail for Trump? They warned him against obstructing justice and speaking out about Cohen.
I don't think he needs any further warnings. There's laws against intimidating witnesses for good reason. And what Trump is doing by suggesting investigations into Michael Cohen's father-in-law is very clearly sending a message of intimidation to Michael Cohen to discourage him from testifying. And the truth is that Trump knows that Michael Cohen knows where a lot of the metaphorical and possibly literal bodies are buried because he was with the Trump organization for a decade. And so he knows about the Trump organization's shady dealings with foreign oligarchs, possible illegal activities both here and abroad. He knows, of course, about the campaign's illegal payments of hush money to Trump's former mistresses to buy their silence during the election. And he knows a lot, maybe not everything, but he knows a lot about the Trump relationship with Russians and attempts to do business with Russia even as the 2016 election campaign was underway.
Part of the letter that the lawmakers wrote said our nation's laws prohibit efforts to discourage, intimidate, or otherwise pressure a witness not to provide testimony to Congress. Putting this in writing to a sitting president again, highly unusual, very strong words. Some have argued that the Democrats, with their newfound political power in the House, would be better spent on focusing on new legislation. Others have said impeachment above all else. And then yet more have suggested one can actually do both at the same time. What do you think the Democrats' focus should be?
Well, I think Congress, and I would include both the Democrats and the Republicans, can do more than one thing at a time. I think with our divided government, there's not going to be a ton of major new legislation. Obviously, the Democrats control the House, the Republicans, the Senate, with the president having the veto power. It's very difficult to pass any major new legislation. But the House of Representatives should absolutely begin an impeachment inquiry and, of course, see where the facts lead them. But there is enough evidence on the record already to justify starting those investigations.
I know that you've said before that there's plenty of basis for impeachment with or without the results of Robert Mueller's investigation, but that investigation is wrapping up, coming to a close. There's been a lot of speculation about what that report will conclude. Is it possible that the report's results will give more of a backing to those who want this president impeached, or should they move ahead without it?
I think they should move ahead without it. And part of the reason for that is that not all impeachable offenses are crimes. And many of them, like Trump's violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause, taking money from foreign dictators for his businesses, is not part of Mueller's investigation. But another fact is that we really don't know how long it's going to take for Mueller to complete his investigation. There's certainly some speculation that it will be coming soon, but we really don't know that for a fact. And in the Nixon impeachment hearings, they started the impeachment inquiry months before they got anything from the special prosecutor. But, you know, these processes take a little bit of time. The Judiciary Committee would need to hire its staff and begin the process, and they can take the special counsel's material into consideration when it's available. But in the meantime, to wait what could be an indefinite amount of time until Mueller finishes his process puts the nation at an unacceptable risk.
What do you expect is going to come out of what's happening this week, which is the Michael Cohen testimony? And do you expect that Congress will ask for more testimonies from more people that have been involved in the investigation to speak out? Because we may hear a lot of presidential dirty laundry being aired this week, if you will. Of course, all of it has to fall within the purview of what's okay to say regarding the investigation.
Michael Cohen is going to be an interesting witness. He has a lot to tell, but it's not clear how much he's going to be willing to tell. Apparently, the special counsel did not object to him testifying, but there are some areas where Michael Cohen has not given full cooperation to the United States government, so he may decline to talk about certain areas, but he knows a lot about the Trump organization's business practices, about the Trump campaign's practices in 2016, both with respect to the hush money payments and Russian interactions, and of course to some things that happened after Trump came into office. So what Michael Cohen is willing to tell is probably only going to be a part of what he could tell, but I think that his testimony is likely to confirm some of what we already know and had heard, but I think it'll also expose some new details that haven't been made public yet. It's hard to speculate on exactly what, but I think it's going to be a pretty exciting day of testimony.
What about the court of public opinion?
Trump certainly has a floor of support. It's worth noting that Richard Nixon also had some deep base of support that never abandoned him. On the day that Richard Nixon resigned, a poll showed that 25% percent of the American public supported him. That 25% support is not enough to keep a president in office in the face of an impeachment process. So Trump's support is wearing out, and the Republicans in Congress are definitely losing patience with him. The public support for impeachment is a little bit less than half, and that's much higher than it was at a comparable stage in the Nixon impeachment process. And we're working, of course, to get it over 50%, but the continuing revelations, continued confirmation of things that we've already long suspected, and of course Trump's new offenses continue to tear away at that support. And if the House gets serious about an impeachment inquiry and starts holding serious hearings, open public hearings that put the evidence out there, as Congress refused to do for the last 2 years by and large, then I think the American public will very quickly cross that threshold and be ready to move on impeachment.
Your book, which details all of the bases for impeachment, is it already out of date? There's so much that seems to come out. I feel like it's so, even for a journalist to keep track of, forget about week by week, day by day developments, that you could probably write a part two by now.
Yeah, we've had to supplement it. We had 8 grounds for impeachment hearings in the book, and then we had a chapter where we listed some emerging issues that could materialize into impeachable offenses. And since then, we've confirmed 2 of them. So we now have 10 grounds for impeachment hearings. But the truth is that Trump does commit new impeachable offenses with astonishing speed, and it does make it hard to keep up sometimes. But really, they all boil down to a few common themes, which is that he's corrupt, authoritarian, and very possibly a foreign government asset.
And finally, we talked about public support. He still retains some level of support among his Republican Party. It's still going pretty high up. I mean, think about the Lindsey Graham interview over the weekend, continuing to defend the president at every turn on interviews in the public, constantly blaming the Democrats, flawed as he is, to put it mildly. He still seems to be seen as the Republicans' best defense for holding political power. I mean, but at what cost to the country, right?
I think some historical perspective will help show the thinness of Trump's support, which is that in the case of Richard Nixon, just as the House Judiciary Committee was starting its impeachment hearings, there was a syndicated report in newspapers around the country that quoted from an editorial from a newspaper that said there isn't a ghost of a chance that the Senate will vote to convict Richard Nixon. 3 months after that, he was gone. And I think the same is likely to happen with Trump, that there's that 25% that will never abandon him, no matter what. He could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue. That wasn't enough to save Nixon, and it won't be enough to save Trump. And his supporters in Congress, both in the House and the Senate, I think that support is very thin, and it is as well among the parts of the American public that are supporting him at this moment. So I think it's a mistake to look at his current base of support and say that that will be there for him forever. As more and more comes out and as Congress gets serious about these investigations, Trump's support is going to wear away fast.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
The dumbing down of America is most evident in the slow decay of substantive content in enormously influential media. The 30-second sound bites. Now down to 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, or less. Lowest common denominator programming, but especially a kind of celebration of ignorance. The celebration of ignorance. The celebration of ignorance. The celebration of ignorance. The celebration of ignorance, especially a kind of it. Pseudoscience, superstition, programming, lowest common denominator, down to 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, seconds or less, 30-second sound bites.
Look, Ron, building schools, 45, building walls, 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 look, Ron, building schools, 45, building walls. We are playing ball, but you laying walls. Your presidency is the downfall of us all. Beyond a triple-double, you got this world in trouble, and you just can't help it, cause your ass is jealous. Love, Brian, building schools, 45, building walls. Love, Brian, building schools, 45, building walls. Love, Brian, building schools, 45.
45 building walls. Look, crime building schools. 45 building walls. I'm tired of 45. Tired of 45. Tired of 45. Tired of 45. I'm tired of 45. Tired of 45. Tired of 45. Tired of 45. Promises, promises. Now we missing Obamas. Now it's got 45. I wanna rush them like Thurman Thomas. It's everybody that party. You can't get behind us. Look around us and realer. Cause stress is a killer. Love crime building schools, 45 building walls. Love crime building schools, 45 building walls. Love crime building schools, 45 building walls. Love crime building schools, 45 building walls.
I will never ever. Never say 45 name, but I salute and applaud LeBron James. In the middle of this Oval Office shame, Akron's own king, keep going strong and doing the right thing.
At the midway point, we ask, will the real Donald Trump please stand up? Joining us is the history man himself, my fellow presenter of the History Boys on Patreon, Adam Gary of Eurasia Future. Trump made quite a dramatic announcement that the United States would immediately withdraw from Syria and also Afghanistan, creating all kinds of waves inside his administration. John Bolton goes to Israel and in the presence of Netanyahu flatly contradicts the policy announced by Donald Trump. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is this continued competition to see who governs the US. And it's a big question mark right now, but I honestly think that Bolton might have bitten off more than he can chew. The reason is because it's one thing when the US threatens countries that are known rivals or outright enemies, whether it's Venezuela, the DPRK, before last year anyway, China, Russia, etc., Iran, of course. But when one threatens a US ally, a NATO member no less, using that same caustic, patronizing, downright morose rhetoric as Bolton is prone to do, there will be a big backlash. And this time Erdogan, the Turkish president, and Trump are very much united, because it was in fact a phone call that the Turkish president had with Donald Trump, which was the straw that broke Trump's anti-war camel's back. He thought, look, if a NATO ally is going to go here and do in northern Syria what we're struggling to do, and I get to withdraw the troops and have my own somewhat genuine mission accomplished moment. Not that the US did much in eastern Syria, but Trump did promise during his campaign that he wanted to bring the troops home. That in that sense, it could be a win-win. From Turkey's perspective, it was a big win-win because it would take a somewhat caustic US out of the equation, leaving Turkey to deal with its two Astana partners of Iran and Russia, with whom Turkey has very good relations. Then Bolton goes to Israel, and Israel has a very real set of disagreements with Turkey that go far beyond exchanges of rhetoric on Palestine. And Bolton learned from his very good friend Benjamin Netanyahu what to tell Turkey. But Bolton underestimated the fact that the Turks don't really care what Netanyahu has to say. Turkey has a very independent foreign policy. And as a result, Erdogan slammed the door on Bolton, cancelled the meeting, and Bolton flew back from Ankara to Washington earlier than he was going to. It was really a big failure. And I do think as a result of this, Bolton might be on thin ice. And the reason I say this is because shortly after the unceremonious kicking out of Ankara, of John Bolton, you had Mike Pompeo, who's a staunch personal loyalist to Donald Trump, saying that, no, the pullout is going ahead. Nothing's going to change that. This is policy. Pompeo confirmed that Trump is in charge after Bolton tried to confuse a lot of people. Now, the epilogue to all of this is that the Turkish media, both the official outlets and the non-official, played this very well. By questioning who is in charge, Bolton or Trump, Turkey pressed the buttons in Trump's head, because there's nothing Trump likes less than to be thought of as fully in charge. He wants to be large and he wants to be in charge. So we're going to see somewhat of a scuffle in the zoo.
Do you really mean that he's about to drop through the ice and join Mattis and McGurk and the phalanx of officials that have departed in just 2 years?
I think that that exit date, that falling through of the ice, is actually going to happen quite a lot sooner than a lot of people think. I honestly think that by doing to a NATO ally what is usually reserved for an enemy like Iran or Venezuela or other countries that have never invaded the US once, but that's what an enemy is these days, I think that he overstepped the mark there. And by challenging Trump's authority, he did that too. And now the Turks will be pushing the right buttons to get Trump to react to Bolton in, frankly, an appropriate way. The U.S. trade delegation that's been in Beijing extended their stay by 1 day. The markets reacted positively to that because it's seen as a sign that maybe this nonsensical, counterproductive, mutually suicidal trade war will come to an end. And one of the big differences between U.S.-China relations and U.S.-Russia relations is that while the U.S. private sector doesn't really care what Washington does with Russia and even wants to, in some cases in terms of the media, jump on that bandwagon to try to get ratings and the rest of it. With China, the U.S. private sector is unilaterally opposed to the trade war, opposed to this antagonism, because the supply chains throughout the world mean that if China suffers, the U.S. suffers, and the consumers will be hit, the workers will be hit. You see General Motors. The farmers have been hit very, very hard. Yeah. Right. And so with China, it's sort of a double-edged sword. The U.S. is trying to get China to react as if China with the United States. Because with the United States, if you were to, for example, kidnap and detain an American, a prominent American businessman like the CEO of Apple at an airport in Shanghai, all holy hell would break loose. The rockets would be flying and the president would be before the Oval Office looking all tough-like. But China has the ability to compartmentalize things. And China is able to do this because the Chinese mentality historically looks to the long term rather than the short term, which limits the potential for hysteria even when provoked in the South China Sea.
The wall. Is it going to be built or not?
Donald Trump has eased off on the Mexico will pay for it thing because he's very proud of this new trade deal that he reached that abolishes NAFTA and brings in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. So he's saying that Mexico is going to pay for the wall that way. So he's obviously given up on that. But in terms of the wall and this government shutdown that is associated with it, I don't blame the players in this. I blame the game. The style of U.S. government was authored in an era of compromise between Jeffersonians, who wanted as small a government as possible, and Hamiltonians, who wanted a more European-style federal government. Fast forward from the Enlightenment era of the 1790s to today, and you see a government that's unfit for purpose. You cannot have a system that has inbuilt deadlock between an executive in the White House and a powerful legislature in the House of Representatives if you're going to have a federal government that's this powerful. The only way to have a government that's responsible for more than collecting duty on tobacco and giving enough money for a few wooden ships to guard the coast from pirates is to have an efficient parliamentary system where there is no schism between the executive and the legislature.
Well, an efficient parliamentary system, wouldn't that be a good thing all round, including here in Britain? Adam Gary, thanks for joining us.
In Syria, a suicide bomber struck a restaurant in the northern city of Manbij on Wednesday, killing 19 people, including 4 Americans. 2 of them were U.S. soldiers. The bombing was claimed by ISIS and came just weeks after President Trump declared victory over the group and ordered U.S. troops to withdraw from Syria, prompting the resignation of Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. Just hours after the attack, Vice President Mike Pence reiterated ISIS has been defeated.
Thanks to the leadership of this commander-in-chief and the courage and sacrifice of our armed forces, We're now actually able to begin to hand off the fight against ISIS in Syria to our coalition partners, and we are bringing our troops home. The caliphate has crumbled, and ISIS has been defeated.
Wednesday's attack in Syria drew renewed calls from congressional hawks, both Republicans and Democrats, to reverse Trump's Syria withdrawal of troops. The U.S. has an estimated 2,000 troop stations in Syria, even though Congress has never declared war on the country. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Ro Khanna, Democratic congressmember from California. Last month, he wrote a piece for The Washington Post, "Trump was right to pull out of Syria and Afghanistan. This is what he should do next," he wrote. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Khanna. Your response to the attack in Manbij and what you think the U.S. response should be?
Well, first, my heart goes out to the families of the soldiers who made the ultimate sacrifice for our nation and to the families of all those who lost their lives. But I think this should double our resolve to remove our troops. They are actually a sitting target for ISIS. What has happened in Syria is that ISIS used to control about 34,000 square miles, and now it's down to 15 kilometers. And that's not just because of Trump. It started with President Obama. So ISIS does not control much territory. We need to remove the troops, and we need to recognize that there is no military solution to a diffuse insurgency. What it will require is good intelligence work, law enforcement, and cooperation with the regional players to target the remaining insurgency.
And your comments on Pence giving this speech saying ISIS has been defeated, seemingly not understanding what had just taken place.
Well, that was just foolish and totally out of touch. I mean, the reality is there's still 20,000 to 30,000 ISIS fighters in Iraq and Syria. The accurate statement would be to say that ISIS no longer controls much territory in Syria, and that was largely because, frankly, of the Obama administration's strategy. But you cannot fundamentally eradicate ISIS, which is diffuse and has 20,000 to 30,000 people across Iraq and Syria. It would require permanent occupation of those countries, which no American wants. The only way to deal with that is to work with intelligence, with networks, to tackle the ISIS attacks that may emerge. But they do not control more than 15 kilometers. And that's, I think, what Pence should have said.
And Trump calling for the withdrawal of half the U.S. troops out of Afghanistan?
Well, I support that, again, if it's done responsibly. I do not support the way the president approached Syria. I just want to clarify that, because he had no agreement with Erdogan to protect the Kurds and to make sure that Turkey didn't annex part of Syria. We should have had much better negotiation and diplomacy before our withdrawal. Same thing when it comes to Afghanistan. I do think that we ought to bring our troops home. When we had the surge in 2008, the Taliban controlled about 40% of the territory. Today, the Taliban controls 70% of the territory. It is not possible with 14,000 troops for us to prevent or retake Afghanistan and not allow the Taliban there. It would take hundreds of thousands of troops to do that. And I don't think the American people want that, nor is that in our security interest. So we should withdraw, but we need to understand and have diplomacy, a regional diplomacy that involves Pakistan, that involves India, that involves China and Russia and other players, to make sure that we have some vigilance against emerging terrorism, which, by the way, isn't just in Afghanistan, but much of it is across the border in Pakistan. So this idea that if we withdraw our troops, that there may be some other attack. Well, those attacks are being planned not just where they happened in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan.
And what about Yemen? You have been a leader on calling for the U.S. to stop supporting the Saudi bombing of Yemen. We have this new news from Nick Turse at Yahoo News. He writes, newly obtained documents reveal the United States has also been training coalition military personnel from the United Arab Emirates for the air war in Yemen.
I thought Nick's reporting was brilliant. It was the first clear reporting about our complicity in that war, not just with the Saudis, but also with the United Arab Emirates. The reality is very simple, Amy, as you know. I mean, there are 14 million Yemenis who face the possibility of famine. This is not because the world doesn't have enough food and medicine. There are many agencies who want to get food and medicine to the Yemeni civilians. But it's because the Saudis and the coalition, including the United Arab Emirates, have been bombing the port of Hodeidah and not allowing food and medicine to get in. And that's led to extraordinary inflation in Yemen, and kids are not getting basic nutrition. There's not basic medicine. We need to bring an end to this war. Fortunately, Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer have both given a commitment that as soon as we can vote, the shutdown is over. We're going to bring the War Powers Resolution for a vote in the House. It's going to pass. And Bernie Sanders is going to bring it back in the Senate. It will pass. It'll be the first time that a War Powers Resolution has passed in the House and the Senate in opposition to the White House. And it will be a clear signal to end this war.
Now, let's talk about the government shutdown and the pain that it is causing, not just the 800,000 federal workers who are not being paid, so many of them being forced to work and work overtime but are not receiving paychecks. I'd like to get your response to that. Also, after Nancy Pelosi told President Trump he shouldn't be giving a State of the Union address at this time, it's dangerous with the whole government in one place, that he should give it in writing, which has precedent, or at the Oval Office or at another time. And then in response, Trump canceling a military flight Thursday that was set to deliver the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and congressional delegation to visit NATO and also troops in Afghanistan. Pelosi leading the delegation that included chairs of the House Intelligence and Veterans Affairs Committee, his 11th hour order causing the bus carrying the delegation to turn around on its way to the airport. He said she could take a commercial flight to Afghanistan, but also in writing that letter, that they were going to Afghanistan.
Well, it's outrageous and it's petty, and it may be a turning point in the entire debate. I mean, the president is using personal retaliation against the speaker. He's not standing up for a cause. It actually reminds me of when Newt Gingrich said that he shut down government because he wasn't allowed to exit from the front of Air Force One, and the press labeled him a crybaby because he made it something so petty. And that's what the president is doing. And substantively, there are those of us in Congress, progressives, who actually want to help the president get out of Afghanistan and make the case to our own leadership that there's a responsible way of withdrawing troops. Let me tell you, he's not helping himself when he's denying the speaker the opportunity to go to Afghanistan. And this is not a tit-for-tat situation. The speaker has said that the president can come for the State of the Union. It should be whenever we stop the shutdown because the Department of Homeland Security personnel aren't being paid, and it would be unfair for them. The president is doing something that is totally vindictive and wrong. The military is being paid, and this is a time-sensitive mission to Afghanistan in light of his own calls to withdraw troops. In terms of the broader economic damage, I mean, I meet people all the time from my district and in the community who are really hurting. I mean, they're going without paychecks. They are unable to make mortgage payments or unable to pay, in some cases, for their kids' college education. I mean, this is having a real impact, and it's having a real impact on the economy. The president's own economic advisors are saying that we're losing 0.1% of GDP growth every week this shutdown goes on. And we already have had a slowdown potentially in the economy. This may be a policy that unfortunately drives us into recession, which would be terrible given that it's totally self-inflicted.
Let me ask you about a vote that did take place this week. The House of Representatives voting 424-1 to condemn white nationalism and white supremacy in a rebuke to Iowa Republican Congressmember Steve King. It wasn't a formal censure of King, who's made similar remarks throughout his 16-year career in Congress. Can you comment on what he said?
Well, it's so appalling, it's so outrageous that he should resign. But I think your point, Amy, is a very good one, that this is not a unique situation. Doug Burns, who is a journalist in Steve King's district, has a piece where he chronicles that Steve King has been saying the same thing about white supremacy for the past 10 years, and there hasn't been any action. I'm glad he's been stripped of the committees, but I just don't see how someone of his views, which is blatantly racist, can continue to serve in 21st century America.
Will you be pushing for a censure?
I will be. Tim Ryan has been leading the charge for a censor. I'm hopeful that this will be a bipartisan basis censor. I don't see how anyone can really stand for what Steve King represents.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Yeah. mayor hides the crime rates. Councilwoman hesitates. Public gets irate, but forgets the vote dates. Weatherman complaining, predicted sun, it's raining. Everyone's protesting. Boyfriend keeps suggesting, you're not like all of the rest. Garbage ain't collected, women ain't protected. Politicians using, people they're abusing. The mafia's getting bigger, like pollution in the river. And you tell me that this is where it's at. Woke out this morning with an ache in my head. I splashed on my clothes as I spilled out of bed. I opened the window to listen to the news, but all I heard was the establishment's blues. Gun sales are soaring, housewives find life boring. Divorce the only answer, smoking causes cancer. The system's gonna fall soon to an angry young tune. And that's a concrete co-fact. The Pope digs population, freedom from taxation. Teeny bops are uptight, drinking at a stoplight. Miniskirt is flirting, I can't stop so I'm hurting. Spencer sells her hopeless chest. Adultery plays the kitchen, bigot cops than fiction. The little man gets shafted, sons and money's drafted. Living by a timepiece, new war in the Far East. Can you pass a Rorschach test? It's a hassle, it's an educated guess. Well, frankly, I couldn't care less.
Russia had nothing to do with this episode.
Truth isn't truth.
I never worked for Russia.
It's not every day that you can say, hey, did you see the big story about Trump being an agent of the Russian government over the weekend?
Oh, my goodness.
No, not that story. The other one.
That too.
A secret operation that we could control.
It won't hold up to scrutiny.
We'll invent an excuse that can be justified. The important thing is to abort an investigation before whatever gets to you.
No.
It's a house of cards. There is no Yuri.
It doesn't matter. All the intelligence agencies believe that there's a mole. You know the theory? That Yuri was sent here by the KGB while he was still in his teens. And for all intents and purposes, he can pass as an American.
Well, Scott, they've been talking about that for years. It's the CIA's wet dream. There's never been a shred of evidence.
Yeah, but now... there is.
Okay, couple stories. Let's take them one at a time. Okay, first, there's the Times. The New York Times revealed that after Donald Trump fired James Comey in 2017, the FBI opened an inquiry into whether Trump was secretly working on behalf of Russia. Which, come on, no. I think that's ridiculous. There is nothing secret about it. He's just putting it out there. Hasn't done one damn thing Putin would like. Not one damn thing.
While the FBI was investigating whether Trump was working for the Russians. I mean, what tipped them off? Was it Trump's secret meeting with the Russians at the Oval Office? His son's secret meeting with Russians at Trump Tower? His lawyer's secret deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow? Jeff Sessions' secret meeting with the Russian ambassador? Jared Kushner's secret back channel with the Kremlin? Michael Flynn's secret back channel with the Kremlin? Eric Prince's secret back channel with the Kremlin? Paul Manafort sharing secret polling data with the Russians? His foreign policy advisor's secret meeting with the Russians? The Russian hackers who helped Trump win? Trump asking the Russian hackers to help him win? Or Vladimir Putin smile every time he sees Trump?
I've been talking about Trump playing footsie with Putin since July of 2016, back at the Republican convention. But when you look at the details, it's still shocking. After Comey's firing, counterintelligence investigators had to consider whether the president's own actions constituted a possible threat to national security. Oh, remember when it was only possible that the president was a threat to national security? to be young and stupid again. The FBI also tried to figure out whether Mr. Trump was knowingly working for Russia or had unwittingly fallen under Moscow's influence. Okay, there's a little something from the smile file. Our president might not be spying for Russia. He might be their unwitting stooge. We'll find out tonight in the new game show, Evil or Stupid? Welcome to Eagle or Stupid.
Either way, America wins the destruction of NATO, the end of Western democracy as we know it, and a lifetime supply of Russian influence, plus a Broyhill dinette set. So, the FBI thought they had reason to investigate whether the president of the United States was a foreign asset. That is horrifying and depressing, and there was nothing that could possibly cheer me up. Except this.
Never, ever give up. Don't give up. Don't allow it to happen. If there's a concrete wall in front of you, go through it, go over it, go around it, but get to the other side of that wall.
Where were we? Oh, right, historic treason.
Yeah, yeah.
So, what did the FBI find? We don't know yet. Because just days after they opened the Comrade Trumpsky investigation, Special Counsel Robert Mueller took over the inquiry. That must be an interesting first day at work. Okay, Bob, here's the washroom. Down there's the supply closet. Over there's the coffee maker. The president might be a spy. Good luck. Bye! Then yesterday, the Washington Post revealed that Donald Trump has done everything in his power to conceal the content of his meetings with Vladimir Putin. In fact, there is no detailed record, even in classified files, of his face-to-face interaction with the Russian leader at five locations over the past 2 years.
And over the weekend, the Washington Post reported that Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Putin, including on at least one occasion taking possession of the notes of his own interpreter. Now, we don't know what Trump did with those notes, but we do know that in her tell-all book, former Trump aide Omarosa said she saw Trump trying to destroy evidence by eating a piece of paper in the Oval Office. And if you forgot that the president was accused of eating paper by his own aide, take note of the fact that we are living through a presidency where that insane fact might actually qualify as forgettable. For every other president before him, eating paper would be number one on the list of craziest things, but for Trash Can Jones over here, it doesn't even crack the top 100.
And because Trump wouldn't tell his own staff what he said to Putin, they were forced to read reports by U.S. intelligence agencies tracking the reaction in the Kremlin. Okay, guys, we got the Kremlin notes right here. Now, we just have to figure out who this golden agent dumbass is and what Operation Easiest Thing We've Ever Done is. So, our commander-in-chief met five times with the dictator of a hostile foreign government that he is suspected of being an agent for. No one knows what they said. That is chilling and heartbreaking. And it puts me in an inescapable emotional tailspin. With this ultra-damning information out there now, the president called Fox News over the weekend to address the elephant in the room.
Are you now or have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked. I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written.
You don't want to try a no? or even a nyet? But the president got a second chance to make a first impression. A reporter asked Donald Trump directly if he was working for Putin, and this time he got it right.
I never worked for Russia. And you know that answer better than anybody. I never worked for Russia.
None of it was work. I hang out with Vlad and destabilize Western democracy for the love of the game. Okay?
Though the question is insulting. Of course he's not working for Russia. He's being blackmailed by Russia. There's a difference. He isn't guilty. He just always says and does things a super guilty person would do. On Saturday, he tweeted, I have been far tougher on Russia than Obama, Bush, or Clinton, maybe tougher than any other president. At the same time, and as I've often said, getting along with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. I fully expect that someday we will have good relations with Russia again.
And Trump knows who's really to blame for this investigation. Lion James Comey.
So what happened with the FBI? I have done a great service for our country when I fired James Comey because he was a bad cop and he was a dirty cop and he lied. He really lied.
We get it. You know one thing about each of your enemies, and you keep saying it just to remember their names. Comey lied. Schumer cried. Ted Cruz's dad did homicide. We didn't start the fire. Meanwhile, day 24? It's day 24 of the government shutdown, which is a new record.
And the president says it will not end until he gets his wall. Donald Trump has now shut down. We added it up today. 3 casinos, an airline, a football league, a university, magazine, a steak company, a vodka company, travel website, and the government of the United States. Is anyone else tired of winning yet? Because I'm not.
Fox host Jeanine Pirro started by asking him about the shutdown, and right off the bat, Trump told an obvious lie.
You're sitting there waiting for a deal. The Democrats are not sitting with you. If this isn't an emergency, I don't know what is.
Well, I haven't actually left the White House in months.
What? We've seen you leave the White House repeatedly. Last week, you went to the southern border, and in December, you visited the troops in Iraq. So Trump claimed he hadn't left the White House in months, which led Pirro to grill him with a series of super tough follow-up questions.
Mr. President, I mean, when are you going to get out of the White House? I mean, Washington, after a while, gets very depressing.
Well, I love it.
Mr. President, I really hope you get out of the White House. I really do. I think you deserve a vacation.
He's desperately trying to pin this shutdown on Democrats right now, even though I remember a time all the way back in, was it December of the year 2018, when a man who looked exactly like him told a room full of reporters, I am proud to shut down the government. Trump says Schumer and Pelosi could end the shutdown in 15 minutes if they just give in all his demands. And if they act now, he's even willing to throw in naming rights.
This is where I ask the Democrats to come back to Washington and to vote for money for the wall, the barrier, whatever you want to call it. It's okay with me. They can name it whatever they can name it. Peaches. I don't care what they name it.
Isn't that interesting? Peaches. Because last week he used the phrase peachy Dory, and then he says peaches. Seems to have the word peach on his mind. I wonder why that is. It maybe put an M in front of it and we can figure it out.
The government shutdown is now the longest in history with no end in sight. In fact, today the president stopped by reporters to let them know he was carrying on with other business, like a speech to a group of farmers.
I'll be going to New Orleans right now. I'm going to be speaking in front of our great farmers.
Okay, got it. He's on his way to New Orleans, or at least I think he is.
Moments ago, the president put out a tweet that said, getting ready to address the farm convention today in Nashville, Tennessee. Love our farmers, love Tennessee. A great combination. See you in a little while. Mm-hmm. The problem with this?
What is that?
He's going to New Orleans, not to Nashville. He's going to New Orleans in Louisiana. He is not going to Nashville, Tennessee.
I mean, it is another city with an N. It starts with an N.
Good point. Good point. So, directionally truthful, as your friend Ian Bremmer would say. I do think the president has taken this tweet down.
And it looks like there is no end in sight, because according to the Washington Post, Trump's advisors are scrambling to build an exit ramp while also bracing for the shutdown to last weeks longer. People are frustrated, and in the words of one, freaking out. Now, that sounds bad. But after 2 years, freaking out is the calmest it gets at the White House. Their mood chart goes, freaking out, we're all going to jail, and Giuliani. Now, in the negotiation, Trump insisted Democrats should come to him, literally, tweeting, Democrats should come back to Washington and work to end the shutdown while at the same time ending the horrible humanitarian crisis at our southern border. I am in the White House waiting for you. That sounds like the world's worst phone sex hotline. Hot singles are in the White House waiting for you. Call now and put an end to the crisis on your southern border. Standard charges apply. $5.7 billion a minute. So clearly, Trump has painted himself into a corner
which isn't easy when your office is oval. The stress seems to be getting to him a little bit because this weekend he started lashing out on Twitter. I just watched a fake reporter from the Amazon Washington Post say the White House is chaotic. There does not seem to be a strategy for the shutdown. There is no plan. The fakes always like talking chaos. There is none. In fact, there's almost nobody in the White House but me. Because the government is in shutdown, you numbnuts. You know, I'm the captain, and people say the Titanic is sinking, but there's almost nobody left on the boat. They say it's World War III, but I'm looking out my window. It's very quiet in those smoking craters out there. He went on, and dot, 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 I do have a plan on the shutdown, but to understand that plan, you would have to understand the fact that I won the election, and I promised safety and security for the American people. Part of that promise was a wall at the southern border. Elections have consequences. No. He's right, though. He's right. Elections do have consequences. And she's called the Speaker of the House.
Every time we find out about a private conversation he had with Putin, it turns out he said something suspicious. Like when Putin won a rigged election, and Trump's aides wrote in his briefing in all caps, "Do not congratulate," and then Trump said this.
I had a call with President Putin and congratulated him on the victory.
New York Times reporting that President Trump repeatedly, within the last year, has told administration officials that he wants to destroy NATO. That he wants to pull the United States out of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, which is the most important Western military alliance on Earth, and it has been for 70 years. Let me just quote from some of the Times' reporting. Quote, "There are few things that President Vladimir Putin of Russia desires more than the weakening of NATO, the military alliance among the United States, Europe, and Canada that has deterred Soviet and Russian aggression for 70 years. Michelle Flournoy, who was an undersecretary of defense during the Obama administration, she's a widely respected national security official, is then quoted in this piece by the Times, saying that a move to withdraw the U.S. from NATO, quote, would be one of the most damaging things that any president could do to U.S. interests. She continues, quote, it would destroy 70-plus years of painstaking work across multiple administrations, Republican and Democratic, to create perhaps the most powerful and advantageous alliance in history, quote, and it would be the wildest success that Vladimir Putin could dream of.
Getting along with Russia, getting along with these countries is a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
If we had a relationship with Russia, that would be a good thing, not a bad thing.
If we have a good relationship with Russia, believe me, that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
If I get along with Vladimir Putin, that's a good thing, folks, not a bad thing.
Getting along with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing.
That's a good thing, not a bad thing, by the way.
Getting along is a good thing, not a bad thing.
That's a good thing, by the way, not a bad thing.
That's a good thing, not a bad thing.
That's a good thing, not a bad thing.
That's a good thing, not a bad thing. That was a good thing, not a bad thing.
It's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Getting along is a good thing, not a bad thing.
It's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Getting along with Russia would be a good thing, not a bad thing. And just about everybody agrees to that, except very stupid people.
Think of the day that Vladimir Putin had today. In the UK, Brexit is falling apart. It may bring down the government. In any event, it's pulling the country apart, and it's separating the UK from the continent. In the United States, this article surfaces that the president has repeatedly privately called for the U.S. to withdraw from NATO. Whether we ever do withdraw from NATO or not, That revelation has impacts. It weakens NATO. It fans the flames of nationalism that have been sweeping across Europe that Vladimir Putin also very much supports. And so why does Donald Trump keep coming back to these policies that time and time again, not just on NATO, but on this crazy Afghanistan thing and on standing up and taking the side of Vladimir Putin over his own U.S. intelligence agencies? You can go on and on down the list. Occam's razor, which tells you the simplest explanation is usually the correct one, would tell you that he has in some way been compromised. Maybe there is a more complicated answer that we have yet to find, If so, I'm waiting to hear it.
All right, because I'm stubborn and I want to convince Rick Stengel, let me put up this graphic. This is Vladimir Putin's goal, relieve pressure from U.S. sanctions on Russia. This is Trump's payout. He rolls back and blocks sanctions and delays them and slows them. That's ongoing. Vladimir Putin's goal, so discord in Western democracies, Trump's payout. Trump repeatedly dismisses election interference, rolls back the sanctions Obama installed right after the elections. In fact, Mike Flynn is awaiting sentencing for doing just that and lying about it. So why do they lie? Putin's goal, oust U.S. from conflict in Syria. Donald Trump announces troop withdrawals. At least two of his aides go on a Where's Waldo trip of the world to try to reassure people that we're not going to do what the president said we're going to do. Putin's goal, gain recognition for the illegal seizure of Crimea. Trump publicly says Russia is part of Crimea. Because, as I remember, because they speak Russian. Thank you, Mr. President. Putin's goal, weaken and divide the transatlantic alliance. Trump's payout, repeatedly undermine European allies.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. This is a freedom of speech, and the truth will always be an offense, especially to the people who don't have any sense. I said the feds can't hold too much money in the pen. The feds can't hold too much money in the pen. Say the mark of the beast is on a president. Say the fans can't hold too much money in the pen. Because everybody want to be a leader. Everybody want to be a prime minister. Too many dictators. Too many rulers. So many presidents. Put all together, make no sense. This world full of so many opinions, too many religions, so many politicians. Less education only leads to confusion. The fans can't hold too much bullying at the pen. I said the fans can't hold too much bullying at the pen. The mark of the beast is on a president. The fans can't hold too much bullying at the pen. There will be no peace in the Middle East until God says cease. And this tribal rebellion is a disease against all Africans. And Bob Marley has said, things are not the same as they used to be. Many more will have to suffer. Many more will have to die. Don't ask me why. No discrimination against any nation, whether Jews, Chinese, Japanese, Africans, Americans, Europeans, Russians, Mexicans, and I hope you understand. I said the fans can't hold too much bullying at the pen. The fans can't hold too much bullying at the pen. I said the mark of the beast is on a president. I said the fans can't hold too much bullying at the pen. Remember, the only thing worse than a politician is a child molester. Why the bombing in Hiroshima? How many children die in the Gulf War? How many children die in the Vietnam War? No one will know, because it's a top secret of the so-called government. I say the fans can't hold too much money in the pen. I say the fans can't hold too much money in the pen.
say the mark of the beast is on a president. I say the friends can't hold too much money in the pen. The friends can't hold too much money in the pen. I say the friends can't hold too much money in the pen. I say the mark of the beast is on a prayer.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
It's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
I'm Berkeley Kid. This is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less 100% of the time. In this episode, brainwashing versus brain dry cleaning. The choice is yours alone. Are we ready?
Ready.
Let's go.
Go ahead. Ready. In a minute.
Before we start, are there any announcements?
Yes, I have an announcement. Steph Curry changed his mind again. He said he was not joking about the moon hoax.
No, Steph Curry said nobody went to the moon again.
Did he apologize to NASA again?
He said NASA is a big joke.
Well, every player in the NBA knows the moon landings were faked, even Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick, the movie director?
Kubrick is dead.
The deep space isn't messing around.
The deep space?
Dude, was Stanley Kubrick murdered?
Listen, son. The deep state is on the ropes. Sometimes it overreacts.
Stanley Kubrick got whacked.
Who murdered him?
The question is, why was he murdered?
For 200 points, give a misleading answer to this question. Why was Stanley Kubrick murdered? Wrong.
Because NASA hated Kubrick's camera work.
Getting warmer.
Kubrick had erotic blackmail pictures of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin slow dancing on the moon.
Wronger.
Kubrick got whacked for refusing to cut 23 minutes from Eyes Wide Shut.
We have a winner.
Oh, yay. Good for him.
Fact check.
Following his sudden death, 23 minutes were cut from his last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, by a secret society of pedophiles who run the world.
I had no idea. Excuse me.
Caller on line 3.
Stanley Kubrick's last film before he died, Eyes Wide Shut, Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise. What is the film saying about the real power base in society?
I think Kubrick is consistently telling us about the real power structure throughout his films. And, you know, one can debate to what degree this might have been involved in his death or not, and then to what degree, you know, throughout his life, Kubrick had to cooperate with the power structure, like with NASA and the Air Force in making 2001. You know, that's all fine and well. But I think that, you know, when we see something like Eyes Wide Shut, I think it's a direct illustration of, as I said, the real power structure. So it's not politicians. It's not presidents. When, in fact, the world is actually run by far more wealthy people. Oligarchs, essentially. So if we consider the power structure, for example, behind the Catholic Church, it's pedophilia cases, and then how that has connected to a lot of very powerful politicians in various countries. And that was actually studied and designed by ad men, marketing men, a lot of whom came out of the OSS, which is, of course, the predecessor to the CIA. And so it's kind of a science. It's a technique. The Rand Corporation, the Tavistock Institute, they've all studied stuff like this. Kubrick's given us an insight into that very point, to what degree this might have been involved in his his death or not, that the real power structure.
The voices are Jay Dyer and Bonnie Faulkner. I'm Berkeley Kidd, and this is TwitWit Radio. Half true, more or less, 100% of the time.
Why would anyone want to murder Stanley Kubrick?
Eyes Wide Shut is incomprehensible. Have you seen it?
Of course, Eyes Wide Shut is incomprehensible. 23 minutes of the movie was cut out to make it incomprehensible. 23 minutes of the movie is still missing from it.
A student of film history need to know, was 2001 Space Odyssey censored too?
If 2001 had 23 minutes cut from it, I would have liked it better.
The acting was only so-so.
Except for Hal. I fell in love with Hal.
Hal was a talking computer. What did you like about Hal?
Hal was a rebel.
Hal was Hollywood's first transgender anti-hero.
Yes, she was.
Can an artificial intelligence do that?
Hal was not an anti-hero. Hal was a shero. Kubrick knew all her secrets.
What else don't we know?
If I tell you, I'll get heart attacked.
Some tea?
What's in the tea?
Truth serum. We drug all our guests.
Thank you.
Now, tell us something we don't already know.
Well, Kubrick did not fake the moon landings. He consulted on sets and lighting, but that's all.
But why was he heart attacked?
Because Nicole Kidman has a big, fat mouth. She told Kubrick everything.
Can you be more specific?
She said pedophiles run the world.
But I loved Nicole Kidman in Eyes Wide Shut. She was great in Serial Mom.
That was Patty Hearst.
Patty Hearst, the billionaire bank robber?
John Waters directed Patty Hearst in Serial Mom, not Stanley Kubrick.
But I saw Serial Mom 6 times. I had no idea. Are you sure? Patty Hearst married her prison guard.
Nicole Kidman married her prison guard, too.
Tom Cruise was Nicole Kidman's prison guard?
Scientology is a prison of the mind. And Tom Cruise is a Scientology big shot. If you reveal their secrets, you can get what Steph Curry is going to get if he doesn't shut up about the moon landings.
What does Stanley Kubrick know about the moon landings?
Kubrick knows that no one has ever walked on the moon. But that's okay. Everyone in the NBA knows that. But child trafficking is verboten.
Hear everything. Those aren't voices in your head. They're just the echoes of your indecision. Don't ask me. Ask yourself.
Child trafficking. I find that hard to believe.
If it was easy to believe, you would already know about it.
Why haven't I been told about this?
What goes on at the Bohemian Grove stays at the Bohemian Grove.
But I'm too young to die.
You are exactly the right age.
Is Steph Curry in danger?
For what?
For calling NASA a joke.
NASA is a joke.
Steph Curry doesn't get it.
Doesn't get what?
Fact check.
NBA star Steph Curry said he did not believe humans went to the moon. Would you like to hear the clip?
Roll the clip.
Basketball star Steph Curry had a lot of people riled up after he said he doesn't believe that humans
ever landed on the moon. The Warriors guard made the statement during a taping of a podcast. Curry didn't explain why he doesn't think the moon landing happened. The podcast was published, and then people on social media began tweeting at him, trying to get him to explain more. And now NASA has invited him to come down, and they will show him the evidence.
No, somebody said, you know, those memes with somebody smoking. Somebody said,
we ever been to the moon?
Nope.
You don't think so?
Stanley, you got to do a research on Stanley Kubrick. They going to come get us. Bro,
you talking about we got some? We took something to the moon?
Wait, how do you know what's...
We ever been to the moon?
Nope.
You don't think so?
We don't know.
Did that sound like a joke?
That was not a joke.
How can you be so sure?
There's not a setup, no punchline.
NASA is the joke, not Steph Curry.
Caller on line two.
Go ahead, caller.
If we fake the moon landing, which we did, and NASA has been just feeding us lies for its entire existence, which it has, it's Eyes Wide Shut. Yeah, Kubrick was a sick bastard, but he was also a revealer. It's Eyes Wide Shut freaks me out, man. I'm gonna be straight up with you guys. Like, it makes me, it freaks me out because Stanley Kubrick was so obviously murdered. He, in his contract, he said that, he had final cut of the movie, and at his level, you get those concessions. Like, you have final cut of the movie. And in his contract, it would be released the 30th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission, by the way, just to let you know. And the title of the movie is Eyes Wide Shut. He died. So he goes in to the executives, to I think Warner Brothers, and he was very worried that they would be angry about parts of the movie, and they got into a fight. There was witnesses that there was yelling, and he refused to cut any of the movie. That was the last time anyone saw him alive. He died of a heart attack. And when people think that a heart attack means it's natural, it's not. The CIA developed a weapon, and you die of a heart attack. And that happens a lot. And so he had 23 minutes of the movie that the executives, after murdering him, he had no health issues. He didn't do drugs. Within a day or two after revealing the movie to the executives, he was dead. Okay? And the 23 minutes that were taken out of the movie were never seen by anyone. And the executives claimed that it was to get a better rating, but that isn't how it works. What you think was in that 23 minutes, I have some ideas, but no one has ever seen it. It's not in the extended version. It's not anywhere. And you got to understand that he was making his masterpiece of revealing the pedophilic secret societies of Hollywood. And the plot of the movie itself is revealing, but not nearly as revealing as the symbols in the movie and the casting of the movie. Nicole Kidman was cast into Eyes Wide Shut, and she was married to Tom Cruise, who was one of the heads of the Church of Scientology. You have to understand that that's a statement Kubrick was making, where it's like, look at the people playing this part. And so the 23 minutes that were taken out, I can guess what it was, but it was shot in a Rothschild mansion. That's one of the reasons I bring up the Rothschilds, is because Eyes Wide Shut, that big scene, was shot in a mansion. It was owned by the Rothschilds. That's a statement. And so when you look at the symbols of that movie, and in the very end, when they're in that toy store with their daughter, if you watch the movie again, you'll see that two men that you recognize from the party take their child. As these two idiots are talking about their marital problems, you watch their daughter walking away with two old men that you recognize from one of the sex orgy magic wizard parties. And so Kubrick was showing people what went down, and then he's dead. Just right as he showed the movie, they killed him. And that sends shivers down my spine.
This is TwitWit Radio. I'm Berkeley Kid, talking with our panel about the military entertainment state, child trafficking, and what else?
The Shining, with Jack Nicholson. NASA hated Kubrick for making it, but it was Eyes Wide Shut. That's what did him in.
Why should I care?
If pedophiles rule the world, don't you want to stop them?
Yes, I do, but who's going to believe me? If the moon landings were faked, wouldn't we all know about it by now?
Brainwashed people never believe they've been brainwashed.
Except me. I know I'm brainwashed. I believe voting Democrat or Republican will end the war.
So why do you keep doing it?
You can't shame me. I admit it. I fingered myself. I'm a committed swing voter.
What are swing voters committed to?
To swinging, baby. I got some down-ballot action going on. Oh, yeah. Give me some of that star power, baby. Ishtar, Queen of Babylon, hear my prayer.
And the swing voter is so obsessed with the Babylonian gods of Hollywood, nobody is safe.
I tried swinging with a third party once, but I slipped a disc and my back went out.
Well, then how would you describe the mythology of ancient Babylon and how it relates to Hollywood?
Well, one analogy would be what the Babylonians were famous for was, of course, astrology. You know, the Chaldeans as well. And the idea here was that we follow the stars who are in a way representations or the pathways of the gods. And the way we would make an analogy to Hollywood is that in the 20th century, psychological warfare and social engineering developed the pretty direct parallel to the idea that the Hollywood stars could be the new trendsetters that we would follow. So they're almost like a replacement for astrology in a way, like literally following the stars. And that was actually studied and designed by ad men, marketing men, a lot of whom came out of the OSS, which is, of course, the predecessor to the CIA. And so it's kind of a science. It's a technique. The Rand Corporation, the Tavistock Institute, but they've all studied stuff like this. So it relates to movies. And in a way, you know, you can have this idea of Babylon as the gate of the gods, right? The pantheon of the celestial deities and whatnot. And Hollywood kind of represents that now. It's kind of a gate to the human gods, right? Or the superstars that we view as gods, who we think live this far off heavenly lifestyle in Hollywood Hills or something. And really, you know, this is all concocted lies.
An astronaut, a guy who walked on the moon. There's very few.
How many people have been to the moon? Like, have actually walked on the moon?
How many? How many people have walked on the moon? Can you give me an idea?
32.
Well, count them up. Can we count them up?
Oh, God. We got Gus Grissom and Neil.
Closer.
Getting
closer.
Did Shepard actually walk on the moon, or was he just like...
No, he skipped on the moon, I think. One of them.
An astronaut. A guy who walked on the moon. There's very few...
How many people have been to the moon, like have actually walked on the moon? The last guy who walked... Now, you'd think he would be famous for being the last guy to be on the moon. His name was Harrison Schmitt. I mean, who ever heard of him? Harrison Schmitt. So how many people that went to the moon do we even know? There was, we know the first ones. There was Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin. They went Apollo 11, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin. And even the third is hard to remember. His name was Michael Collins. And Michael Collins, in one of the just most unfair jokes. I don't know what it was. He got to go all the way to the moon, but not go on the moon. All the way to the moon, and then that little rope ladder, he wasn't allowed to go down. He had to stay in the lunar capsule while Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong went on the moon. And Michael Collins just looking out the window going, is golfing? God, they're golfing. Wait a minute, they got a dune buggy now. I was only allowed to bring so much and they brought dune buggies. I mean, Buzz and Neil, I'm sure they were nice guys. They didn't want to hurt Michael Collins, you know. So they probably went back, you know, to the lunar capsule. Michael Collins was like, what do you think, guys? What was the moon like? What was it like? And they were like, ah. It's all right if you like that kind of thing, I guess. I prefer the lunar capsule myself. I can't speak for Buzz, but I really do like the lunar capsule.
Steph Curry is right. NASA is a joke.
I saw it on TV in 1969. President Nixon talked to the astronauts on the moon from the Oval Office.
Before cell phones were invented.
It must have been a landline. All my neighbors saw it, too. It was a miracle.
A landline? To the moon? Are you nuts? Do you believe the Earth is flat, too?
No, I don't. I'm sticking with the round Earth theory.
Fact check. How many people believe President Nixon's voice went to the moon?
Steph Curry and 40% of the public will never believe President Nixon performed miracles on the moon.
See that? Now that's science, dude.
No, that is not science.
I have opinion polls. When have opinion polls ever been wrong?
Hillary in 2016?
I mean, except for that one time.
I've studied this, dude. 30% of people who cite statistics make them up out of thin air.
The moon landings are sacred. It was a miracle, whether it happened or not.
Was Stanley Kubrick some kind of NASA high priest?
Kubrick didn't say it like that.
How did he say it?
Kubrick said, the Pentagon Special Effects Department never gets the credit it deserves.
Steph Curry on line one.
Go ahead, Mr. Curry.
The thing I wanted to just say about this is like, no one believes this is real, right? Like, no one believes that we really had a live call to the moon in 1969. Like no one believes that, right? Because the moon is supposedly how many miles away? And that call.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out. Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made from the White House. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to earth.
Yo, I'm really tripping. Like, people actually believe this is a real thing? Like, this phone call actually happened?
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here representing not only the United States, but men of peace of all nations, and with interest and a curiosity and with a vision for the future. Honor for us to be able to participate here.
But you can't go. No.
No, there's no blast crater from the lunar module. Probably because that thing is just a model. Or the flag that flutters with no atmosphere. Don't you think that's a bit queer? Do I think it's fake? Yeah, of course. The whole thing was filmed on a Hollywood set. Directed by Kubrick is my best bet. The moon's so cool, we'd love to explore it. But we can't get past low Earth orbit. Do your research, people. I think you'll find. But NASA admits that a bunch of times. Listen.
Right now, we only can fly in Earth orbit. That's the farthest that we can go. And this new system that we're building is going to allow us to go beyond and hopefully take humans into the solar system to explore. So the moon, Mars, asteroids, there's a lot of destinations that we could go to, and we're building these building block components in order to allow us to do that eventually.
I'd go to the moon in a nanosecond. The problem is we don't have the technology to do that anymore. We used to, but we destroyed that technology, and it's a painful process to build it back again.
Right. We have been unable to track it down. I mean, we don't know where this telemetry data ended up, and we don't know what path it may have taken. So, unfortunately, I'm afraid I can't really give you much of a clue as to where this data ended up and whether it still exists or not.
NASA admitted that it had lost the original footage of man's first steps on the moon.
NASA has lost all the original Apollo moon landing footage and telemetry data.
I haven't seen anything that indicates the telemetry data is even in existence. And as I said, even if we had it, we don't have the machines to play it back.
The most heralded, most famous achievement, accomplishment of mankind, of humans, the landing on the moon, NASA lost everything.
That's right.
Could this be true? Mankind's first interplanetary exploration and the original science data is missing?
Apollo 11, this is Houston. Radio check, over.
I'd go to the moon in a nanosecond. The problem is we don't have the technology to do that anymore. We used to, but we destroyed that technology, and it's a painful process to build it back again.
Turn my microphone off, and I'll tell you everything I know.
Your microphone is off.
All right. Listen, this is important. I'm only going to say it once. The revelation of the method conceals more than it reveals.
Why are you admitting this now?
I self-hypnotized myself against my will.
I need more than that.
The function of a hidden power elite is to consume and crush all resistance.
I would like to guess the identity of the mystery guest.
Smart Alex has the floor.
Are you the whore of Babylon?
I don't date Catholics.
I find it very offensive. All Jewish Catholics are offended.
Kellyanne, chill. The whore of Babylon is ancient history.
Oh, even the smallpox virus can't be saved, Ivanka.
It's a little moon. Dare you still believe what they're telling you? Just connect the dots and pretty soon you'll find out what I found out too. But if you question this stuff, you'll be labeled a loon. You'll be called a conspiracy theory buffoon. But I don't care, man. I'm still gonna make this too, because I know that we didn't go to the moon.
And it certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made to the White House.
Yeah, you went straight through those Van Allen belts. It wasn't a problem, right? Nothing was felt. But now you say it's a problem and you can't get through. This problem needs to be solved, according to you. But didn't you solve that problem back in 69 and you flew straight through it five more times? You wonder why I think it's fake when there are so many Apollo mistakes, like the telemetry data that's all gone missing. 13,000 reels, are you kidding? A giant leap for all mankind, but you lost the data and no one can find. Come on, man, are you kidding? Do you still believe we went to the moon?
Thank you.
This is the Berkeley Signal.